Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Gun control advocates say they'll accept no more excuses for why Florida can't adopt an assault weapons ban.
There is not a one answer. It's not just one thing that we can do, but we have to do something.
Also this week, Florida lawmakers look at the connection between mass violence and mental illness and how more mental health care may help break the connection.
If we can get ahead of that curve, we can stop these acts before they decide on a weapon, before they pick a location.
We'll also discover that in the midst of a growing Florida farming crisis, a plant called hemp is being held as a potential savior. And we'll learn that some heretofore liberal issues are beginning to find more support among those identifying as conservative. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. When it comes to the preferred weapons of choice for mass shooters, AR-15-style rifles are high on the list. Variants of the AR-15 were used by gunmen at the Las Vegas Harvest Music Festival shooting, as well as the Sandy Hook and Marjorie Stoneman Douglas school shootings. That gun has taken much of the blame for lost lives and is itself the target of proposed gun bans across America. Blaze Ganey has more.
Colt, a gun manufacturer, has announced plans to stop making AR-15 rifles for consumers. But the company isn't the only manufacturer, and some are calling for a ban on the guns overall. In Florida, Ban Assault Weapons Now, a group run by Gail Swartz, the aunt of a student killed in the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting, is sponsoring a citizens' initiative to ban so-called assault weapons.
What we're trying to do is prevent the sale of military-grade assault weapons, such as the AR-15 and the AK-47, being sold in the state of Florida.
Longtime NRA lobbyist Marion Hammer says the proposed ban is too broad. She says it isn't clear which guns will be impacted.
There is no statutory or legal definition of the term assault weapon, whereas most definitions can be precise. This is an imprecise term. Assault weapon is an imaginary term that has no limit and no boundary.
Hammer says typically gun bans specifically mention the types of guns, while the proposal uses an all-encompassing term.
Proponents of banning semi-automatics have simply used a huge litany of semi-automatic firearms by name. The drafter of this amendment took the easy way out and just banned all semi-automatic rifles and shotguns.
But gun store and range owner Charlie Strickland doesn't think listing the gun by name would have helped either.
If you said the AK-47 style and the AR-15 style, I promise you next week there'd be another, that we'd go M14 style rifle would come back immediately. They're still out there, and they take a box-fed magazine. They're semi-automatic.
Strickland says banning guns is difficult because no matter how they're defined, some guns will be included that many people think should be left out.
Now, when they added shotguns, they really went the bridge too far.
According to the Financial Impact Estimating Conference, half the shotguns available for sale would be banned if the petition is approved by voters. But that's a loss Hialeah Democratic Representative Cindy Polo is willing to take.
There is not a one answer. It's not just one thing that we can do, but we have to do something.
State estimators say the state could lose close to $30 million in revenue if the ban moves forward. And Strickland says for him, the ban would mean a loss of about 15% of his business. To that, Polo says those numbers are nothing compared to a life.
Whether it's a young child, whether it's any one of us, I believe that our loved ones would think that that outweighs any sort of number that a study would prove.
Polo thinks Americans have been living in fear for too long. She wants action to be taken now, and she's not alone. March for Our Lives is a youth-led movement for greater gun control. It began after the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas school shooting. Alyssa Akbar has the FSU chapter and says the time for gun control reform is now.
If they continue to ignore the voices of their constituents, then they better be prepared to be voted out come next election year. It is my pleasure to say that as long as representatives like Attorney General Moody fight against gun violence prevention efforts, the activists standing around me will be here to call them out on their bull.
Attorney General Ashley Moody has filed a motion asking the Supreme Court of Florida to block the proposed gun amendment because the proposed language is a trick.
Lawmakers took some time this week to consider the causes of mass violence and how mental illness could play a part. Gina Jordan says the discussions came amid a request for more mental health funding for schools.
As schools work to upgrade their security and safety measures, the House Pre-K through 12 Appropriations Subcommittee heard about a request for more funding for mental health services. The Department of Education wants the number boosted from $75 million to $100 million for public schools. The increase is supported by Lecanto Republican Representative Ralph Masullo.
I want to thank you for the increase in mental health, which, as you mentioned, wasn't even a category a few years ago. My question is, you said it would increase the ratio of the mental health counselors to students in the schools. Do you know what that ratio is? First question. The second question is, how does that ratio compare with other states?
Public Schools Chancellor Jacob Oliva says the state's current ratios are nowhere near the recommended ranges, but there have been some gains.
School counselor is one of our categories. The national experts recommend about a 1 to 250 student adult to student ratio. Currently, I want to say we're close to between 1 to 400 to 500, which is a decrease over the last couple of years. We've added almost 500 to 600 school counselors statewide throughout the last 2 years when we've had this additional categorical to support access to mental health services. We see the same ratio recommendations from 1 to 250 between school social workers and students, and then school psychologists to students is between 1 to 800 or 1 to 1,000.
Also this week, lawmakers had questions about gun control and whether banning semi-automatic weapons would cut down on attacks like the one last year at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School.
It doesn't matter the weapon. It doesn't matter where they choose to conduct the attack. It doesn't matter the ideology, because if we can get ahead of that curve, we can stop these acts before they decide on a weapon, before they pick a location.
Florida Department of Law Enforcement Commissioner Rick Swearingen told the Senate Committee on Infrastructure and Security that behavioral threat assessment is the key.
We often hear after these attacks that the person had to be crazy or that they simply snapped. Several seminal studies have shown that while some assailants had a history of mental illness, it is rarely the key or causal in these attacks.
Rodney Moore is the Department of Children and Families Assistant Secretary of Substance Abuse and Mental Health. He also told lawmakers mental illness does not equate to violence.
Most individuals who perpetrate violence do not have a major psychiatric diagnosis, and the large majority of people with a diagnosis of mental illness are not violent towards others. The overwhelming majority of people with a diagnosable mental illness do not engage in violent acts towards others, but are more likely to be victims themselves.
Florida lawmakers rejected a call for a special session on gun violence last month after deadly mass shootings in Ohio and Texas this summer. Senate President Bill Galvano has asked Infrastructure and Security Committee Chairman Tom Lee to investigate whether further action is needed after laws were passed last year in response to the Parkland school shooting. I'm Gina Jordan.
Still to come on Capitol Report, during this first of several committee weeks in Tallahassee, Florida lawmakers started wrestling with the challenge of creating a brand new cash crop for the state called hemp.
Our goal is not to destroy anybody, is to work as much as possible with that producer to get them and to allow the harvest hemp legally.
The state's chief economist says Hurricane Michael recovery is slow going.
The damage was so bad and the insured rates were lower than what we normally see.
And after years of essentially denying the existence of people-influenced climate change, some Florida Republicans are adjusting their viewpoints.
We need to stop being afraid of words like climate change and sea level rise.
The state of Florida is refining draft rules for its hemp program, which officials expect to become a multi-million dollar business within a year. Ryan Daly has more.
The list of rules is long.
You would go in, have your fingerprints run. FDLE will deliver the results of those fingerprints to the department. The producer has to notify the agency 24 hours before they harvest. We're requiring producers to notify the department within 48 hours of every time they plant.
That's Stephen Hall, the Florida Department of Agriculture's top attorney. He read existing rules and gave updates on a few changes from what was originally drawn up. The first draft was released in July.
The sampling will be done by the producer, which is a difference from what we had proposed before. Previously, we'd had the department taking the sample, but we had had concerns about being able to get to every producer when they're ready to harvest.
Producers must have hemp tested by an independent laboratory to ensure their plant meets the 0.3% THC threshold, the high-inducing chemical in marijuana. If there are negligent violations of that threshold, growers get three strikes, then face being banned from growing hemp for 5 years. But there was more insight, perhaps, in the discussion surrounding those rules than in reading the rules themselves. One of the apparent sticking points for the state at the moment? Certified seeds and propagules.
Growers must use certified seed or certified cultivars, or seed grown by one of the universities in one of the pilot projects.
The pilot projects Hall references are those at the University of Florida and Florida A&M University, and the cultivars are hemp clones or propagules. But what doesn't seem completely worked out yet is who will do the certifying. More than 30 years ago, the Department of Agriculture joined with Georgia and Alabama to set up a certifying body at Auburn University. But that's the only one Hall knows of.
As of now, the only one, the official one, or the one that exists currently for the state of Florida, is the one that we share with Alabama, Georgia at Auburn.
Hall says there is a process by which other entities can become certifiers, but it can be expensive and timely. And finding an organization that certifies hemp clones, it's been impossible thus far, according to Hall.
We have not spoken with any certifying agency in the world that is currently certifying clones. Everybody we've spoken with says they are not.
Lawmakers also heard about a loophole in hemp regulation that ties into public health concerns, CBD vape products. Hall says CBD vape products are completely unregulated in the state, causing concern at the agency. He adds that concern has been amplified by recent nationwide headlines reporting health problems linked to vaping.
In discussing with DBPR, they have made it very clear to us that their regulation over anything vaped ends with tobacco products. And our limitation, any tobacco products with tobacco in it, and our limitations regarding CBD as a food ends with ingestion. So I would suggest that there appears to be a hole in the regulation.
Hemp's legalization has also made waves when it comes to policing and prosecuting marijuana cases. The state's cannabis director, Holly Bell, told legislators law enforcement in the state may be a step closer to getting a field test that can actually tell the difference between marijuana and hemp. Bell says her office has been working with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement on finding a device that can perform the test on a roadside without having to be sent to a lab.
There is a kit that they can buy that we found that comes out of Switzerland that is about this big and is exactly like the previous type of kit that they've used, and it will test for levels of there on a roadside.
Bell says each kit costs $6.50. Confusion over testing earlier this year caused some state attorneys to halt prosecution on marijuana possession cases. The U.S. Attorney for Florida's Northern District has offered to prosecute cases for the state, but says the focus will be on large-scale trafficking offenses. As the agency moves to finalize rules, Bell says hemp growing permits look to be on a track to be issued in January of 2020. Bell previously said in May the state could have permits ready by the end of the year, but she says rulemaking at the state and federal level is what's holding the process up.
Our team at FDACS is ready to issue permits. We ourselves are ready to go. What I'm waiting for now is the process of the rulemaking.
Bell says the U.S. Department of Agriculture isn't reviewing any state's plans for hemp programs while their rules aren't solidified. But she says the feds are allowing states to proceed if they've met certain criteria. The state's pot czar predicts about 3,000 people will get grow permits at the outset. I'm Ryan Daly.
It's taking residents in the panhandle longer to recover after Hurricane Michael than it typically takes after a hurricane hits Florida. That's something the state's chief economist says lawmakers should keep in mind as they start thinking about next year's state budget. Regan McCarthy reports.
Typically after a hurricane, revenue climbs as residents work to rebuild their homes and businesses. But following Hurricane Michael, the state's chief economist, Amy Baker, says officials are seeing something different.
Normally, you at least see an infusion of dollars coming in from people receiving their insurance payments that kind of quickly helps with rebuilding and jumpstarts activity. Because the damage was so bad and the insured rates were lower than what we normally see, the recovery is slower.
After most hurricanes, Baker says officials can count on an influx of revenue in the area from construction. But she says following Michael, many families are putting off projects while they wait to save up the cash, which means any revenue from construction is being spread out over a longer period of time.
And the other thing we had to think about, for those that had to pay out of cash, what decisions would they make? So, you know, if you had the ability, you might replace that porch, for example. If you don't have the financial means to do it immediately, you may delay replacing the porch and just put up steps. And that's in a good case. You certainly saw more damage than that.
Baker says that makes projecting a time frame for recovery difficult.
That spread out in time really raises a question of what you're going to see when. Not that it wouldn't ever happen, it's just pooled out over a larger number of years.
Earlier this year, a Bay County consultant estimated it would take at least a decade for recovery in that area, one of the hardest hit by Hurricane Michael. I'm Regan McCarthy.
For years, certain issues such as climate change and LGBTQ rights have been solidly associated with the Democratic side of the political spectrum. But now some Florida Republicans are beginning to adopt a more bipartisan view on these matters. Robbie Gaffney has more on how lawmakers are working to make changes in the coming 2020 legislative session.
Protecting LGBT people from discrimination isn't a red or blue issue. It's a human issue.
Mm-hmm. That's queen.
Tampa Republican Representative Jackie Toledo is backing the Competitive Workforce Act. The bill was last sponsored by Florida Republican Party Chairman Joe Gruters, but it died in the 2019 legislative session. Now, Toledo is taking up the mantle. She says without an anti-discrimination legislation, big corporations might not move to Florida.
As a proud conservative, standing up against discrimination is natural because we value individual freedom, hard work, and opportunity for all.
Toledo is joined by St. Petersburg Democrat Daryl Roussan, who is sponsoring the Senate version of the bill.
The Competitive Workforce Act does nothing more than prohibit LGBT Floridians from being fired from their job or being denied public housing or accommodations.
And that's not the only issue bringing Republicans and Democrats together. Republican House Speaker Designate Chris Sprouls says it's time to take climate change more seriously.
We need to stop being afraid of words like climate change and sea level rise. Frankly, we do this too often as conservatives.
That attitude is something climate change advocates are glad to see.
What do we want? Climate justice!
Students skip school to participate in a strike for climate justice. Charlotte Stewart Tilley is a student who helped organize Tallahassee Strike.
This is a school strike for the climate, or Fridays the Future. We are a group of students who are striking for the climate. We were refusing to go to school on account of the lack of action against the climate crisis.
Helen Rose is the director of religious exploration at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Tallahassee. Rose was present at the march and says there aren't enough conservatives joining the cause.
It's becoming more and more common sense. It's becoming more and more ridiculous not to be on board.
Democratic Representative Ana Askamani and Senator Jose Rodriguez are refiling a bill to put Florida on a path toward 100% renewable energy by 2050. They call Sproul's words a good sign. I'm Robbie Gaffney.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this evening, we began this week's Capitol Report with a few stories about gun violence, and we're revisiting that issue to close out the show. Teachers, students, and families from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School didn't want people to forget how their lives were changed, so they told their stories to a former student who's been collecting them. A year and a half after the shooting, WLRN's Katie Swatowski visited a new exhibit at the Coral Springs Museum of Art that tells these stories through photography and sound.
So when you come in, the first few photographs are looking to the left, because that's the way you'll be walking.
The photographs Ian Whitland points to are all faces. In a multi-room gallery, his voice bounces off the wooden floors as he shows me the faces of students and former students. Teachers.
And then it varies. You'll see some walls are grouped as students, some are grouped as teachers, some are a mix. And then as you get to the end, there's some of the families of the victims.
All of them have been affected by the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School a year and a half ago. Whitland graduated from Stoneman Douglas in 2001. He took these photos. They're in a new exhibit.
Anguish in the Aftermath, Examining a Mass Shooting.
51 of Whitland's portraits have recently gone up at the Coral Springs Museum of Art. They're giant photographs, more than 2 feet by 3 feet, all in black and white. And the way they're framed in the glass opposite one another, it creates a mirrored effect. You can see the faces of one survivor when you look at another.
You see the reflection of the teachers behind them, and it kind of shows the interconnectedness of everyone.
The photos are all candid. Whether it's looking away or wiping a tear, the faces aren't just sitting posed and pretty. Whitland says there's a reason for that.
Going back to Columbine, what I've seen in history books are portraits of people, beautifully done, beautifully lit, don't get me wrong, but they're more along the lines of posed photo. I never really connected with that. I don't know how other people feel, but when you think of history and you really want to connect with something, it's something that's raw and visceral.
Emotion is what he wanted. Not any pro or anti-Second Amendment statements, even though he knows some people will experience it that way.
The project is completely apolitical. So what they have to say and what they've been through, I want people to be able to see and get back to the matter at hand, how this affects people in our society.
To capture how surviving a mass shooting really affects different people, Whitland asked everyone who sat to talk to him the same two questions.
Please tell me your personal experience on February 14th, 2018, and then what would you like to see come from this?
He recorded their answers, and as you move through the exhibit, you can hear each person tell you in their own words. Like Diana Hineski, the media specialist at the Stoneman Douglas Library. In her photo, she's looking away from the camera and down. Whatever she had been saying, the photo was taken while she stopped and held her breath. Next to her picture, Hineski's story pours out of a handheld speaker. On the day of the shooting, she kept students in an equipment room in the back of the library. This is her voice in the exhibit.
We got 55 kids in there and 5 adults, which seems like such a big number. We were all on the floor, hiding behind carts and things. And because of the radio, I started hearing that they were looking for a shooter, which just, you know, put us in a fight or flight mode in a place we couldn't do either.
So whining in the background is the school's therapy dog, River, who lives with Hineski now. While she had her portrait taken by Whitland, River came along. And when Hineski came back to the museum to see the exhibit for the first time, River came too.
All right, so we're going to mine.
Yep. And I can walk you through everything after, or you can walk through it now. Okay. So it's up to you, whatever you feel at ease with.
Okay.
It can be a bit overwhelming at times.
Oh, what happened to my face? And then I realized that's a breath in there. And I'm like holding on to that air, and you could see it right there on my cheek. And it's amazing that you captured that.
You had taken in a breath, and you weren't letting it out.
Aneski says it's ironic that she was holding her breath while she was remembering what had happened. Now, breathing is a part of her healing.
This is basically how I've gotten through everything, by breathing. You know, we do these meditations, it's like breathe in love, breathe out peace. But I feel very hopeful because, you know, I feel like I look different now than then. I want more joy.
Portrait to portrait, the healing process looks different for everyone a year and a half later. You see shock, anger, sadness, and signs of strength. There's one image with a young man almost covering his face with his hand. His eyes are closed and he's wiping away a tear. Spencer Blum graduated last year. He was a junior when the shooting happened. In the exhibit, you hear Blum recount some of the details from that day. The radio on his drive home from school.
And as we're in the car with my stepdad and my sister and my sister's friends, we hear Wolf Blitzer saying, there was a shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. We're letting you know more news. And then I remember as the day kept going on, the number of people who were dead just continued to rise.
After he safely evacuated campus, he learned one of his close friends, Nicholas Dworet, was among those killed. Blum says his experience telling Whitland his story was a cathartic one. He talked to me on the phone from his new college dorm room in Tampa after Whitland emailed him his portrait.
It conveyed in that one photograph so much power and emotion and feeling. That's really what's so great about this project is it, one, allowed people to heal, but it's also allowing people who might want to understand a bit more about what we went through and what we experienced to come in and, you know, hear how we felt and then kind of get a better understanding of how difficult it is to really heal.
And Blum says there are plenty of people outside of Parkland who need reminding that healing is an ongoing process after a mass shooting.
People never cease to amaze me. And that is both in a good way and a bad way. I cannot tell you how many people in the past have felt obligated or compelled to randomly give us their opinions. You know, when people can go in and then they can see this, it can give them a better perspective of, or at least what we experienced.
The exhibit's photographer, Ian Whitland, wants to keep taking photos of Stoneman Douglas survivors.
You know, there's people who aren't ready to speak yet. There's people that 2 years from now might be ready to speak, and I'm happy to talk to them then.
After Coral Springs, the exhibit will travel around South Florida first. And Whitland hopes it can reach other communities recovering from mass shootings of their own, like El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. I'm Katie Swatowski in Coral Springs.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to Robbie Gaffney. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Please join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.